From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. We're going to talk about the our great soldiers, men and women that have fought for us in the past and fighting for us now, with Ryan Mannion, president of the Travis Mannion Foundation, and has dedicated his life to supporting our nation's military veterans and families of fallen heroes 2 days from Veterans Day. And Byron York at the bottom of the hour, so because so much is changing on the political field, and we are getting information now that it looks like Naomi Biden, the granddaughter of President Biden, was nearly carjacked today. It turns out the Secret Service had to draw guns and fired shots but missed. The guys got away. We'll tell you what's going on in Washington. I mean, they're shooting Washington commander running backs. They're shooting president's granddaughters. When are they going to get the message that you have to prosecute crime? Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
On Saturday, Speaker Mike Johnson presented a funding plan, and he essentially kind of came up with a two-step plan, which is the only difference from how Kevin McCarthy did it. His suggestion is for Pelosi-level spending.
Yeah, unbelievable. Olivia Beavers weighs in from Politico. Talking about CR time. Yes, it's true. With 5 days to shut down, Speaker Johnson is talking continuing resolution as a solution. The last speaker that did that lost his job. We look at the stakes, the Senate, and more.
Number two.
When I go back to Iowa, it will not be as a presidential candidate. I am suspending my campaign. I think the voters have been really clear that they're telling me not now, Tim.
Not never, not saying not never, just not now. 2024, a major name drops out of the GOP race, and it's Tim Scott. And President Biden moves to re-election mode. Skeptic surge, by the way, on the left. We bring you inside the sprint to the official 24 campaign.
Number one.
I don't think it will be enough to deter Iran. I think Iran sees great value in stretching U.S. forces. Look, we've deployed two carrier groups, Patriot missiles and aircraft, to the region. And that's exactly what Iran wants, as well as their allies, Russia and China.
I tell you what, I think that Russia and China want it. I'm not sure Iran wants all our firepower there, because we might just use it. Maybe not this president, but another one. Israel at war, America at risk. After 46 attacks, the first series of return fire by U.S. forces on Iranian militia, plus the future of Gaza and the protest pushback. All right. First, let's talk about what's happening with Israel at war. The IDF says they supply 300 liters of fuel to that hospital. Everyone said, oh, what about the hospital? What about the hospital? Hamas didn't let them deliver the fuel to the hospital. Underneath that hospital, and this is what Israel says, is this huge network of tunnels, pretty much the headquarters, because they know that most civilized nations wouldn't bomb a hospital, but they would blow up tunnels, and that's exactly what they're looking to do. They say, Israel says, just give us the hospital. We'll take care of everybody inside of it. So the troops risk their lives to hand deliver 300 liters of fuel to the Shifa hospital for urgent medical purposes, and guess what? They wouldn't allow to take it. And there's a big push now for a ceasefire. Look, I don't know how many civilians were killed. I don't want one civilian killed, but it's not the intention. Hamas's intention, though, is to kill them all. What people should understand is this isn't, well, if you only gave Palestine a homeland, they wouldn't have this problem. Nothing to do with that. And the more we dig into this, the more you have to realize this is not to do with the Palestinian Israelis. This is jihadists looking to destroy every Jew on the planet, every Christian, and they're coming for us next. But Emmanuel Macron didn't seem to get the message. Cut one.
I think this is the only solution we have. This ceasefire. Because it's impossible to explain. We want to fight against terrorism by killing innocent people. De facto, today, civilians are bombed. De facto, these babies, these ladies, these old people are bombed and killed. So there is no reason for that and no legitimacy. So we do urge Israel to stop.
Right. Stop bombing. Just let Hamas get out. They just like civilians anyway. It'll be pretty easy. That's pretty good because there's nobody on their border trying to bomb them. And in World War II, when they were trying to get their country back from Nazi Germany, remember that? Do you think there were civilians killed then? Absolutely. But were the stakes high enough to understand that civilization was at stake? Yes. And to make it easier on my illustration and verify and validate it's the analysis, an Arabic copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf is found on one of the bodies of Hamas terrorists and was also found another one in a child's bedroom in Gaza. They also kidnapped a three-year-old, but first killed their parents. That three-year-old, an American. So the hostages, 244, the way they chopped up people, the way they gloried, just had they actually felt glory in killing people. That is why Israel realizes Hamas cannot survive. Now, for I don't know what happens next in Gaza, and neither does Benjamin Netanyahu. He does not know what happens. And you know what? His career is probably over after the October 7th attack that happened on his watch. But I know this. They can't live with any semblance of Hamas next door. None. Mike Lawler, New York congressman, first term on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. Of course, never has George Stephanopoulos on it. Cut eight.
The bottom line here is, yes, we need to provide humanitarian relief, and we want to avoid civilian casualties. But this 11,000 civilian number that keeps getting repeated by the press is factually wrong. Within that number, thousands of Hamas terrorists have been killed. And obviously, Hamas is using these civilians as human shields. And so the oppressor here, the people that are responsible for the deaths in Gaza, is Hamas.
Can people understand that? Can Macron understand that? Can we understand that those protesters in the street for Hamas, they are supporting this? And if they don't, then they should get out of the street and stop embarrassing themselves. So this is something you need support. It's going to be brutal, but nothing is more brutal than October 7th. It's as if 60,000 Americans were killed within a matter of hours. That's the analogy. Douglas Murray just got back, and he saw the demonstrations against, and he sees it everywhere in his former country, Britain, and his current country, America. And he thinks we're at a turning point. Cut 10.
They're mainly made up of two groups of people. The majority are Muslims and people who, the Muslim faith, who always feel incredibly enraged whenever Israel is involved in the conflict and never come out on the streets when their fellow Muslims are being massacred in Yemen, Syria, or anywhere else. But there's also a sort of second and smaller group in these crowds, in Britain, in Berlin, as in America, which is a group of sort of far leftists who basically use this strange imposition of American recent interpretation of American history and put it onto the Middle East, which is why you hear people talking about colonialism and first peoples and much more. It's a real demonstration of incredible ignorance.
Yes, Douglas Murray is going to be on a little bit later, so we'll talk about that. The other big news that I was shocked at, Tim Scott was only in single digits. Everyone liked him, doing better at every debate, got a lot of time this debate, but has not been resonating. His personal bio story is the story, but if you dig deeper on Tim Scott, he comes out even better. Worked well on police reform. Worked well on tax reform. Was extremely productive in his enterprise zones with President Trump. And he also was a great ally for President Trump when it comes to race relations. And he said, you know, sometimes the president could be a little ham-handed, but he was far from ever racist. Good friend. I think that he is definitely eligible and would be a good choice as a second, as a running mate, if Trump gets the nomination. But for the most part, he's done. Why? He had money, but he didn't have polling. And if you can't get on that stage for the debate, that's why I think that Doug Burgum's probably gone, because even though he's got the money and he's got a great job and he's got people that know him, love working with him, I just don't see it. So I just texted Trey Gowdy. He thought that Tim Scott was eventually going to drop out because he wasn't resonating. He doesn't want to spin his wheels, but was shocked when he heard this last night on his show. Cut 25.
One of the things I would recommend to every single American, I know it's not possible, by the way, if you ever want to love your country more, run for president. Traveling this country, meeting people has been one of the most fantastic experiences of my entire life. I love America more today than I did on May 22nd. But when I go back to Iowa, it will not be as a presidential candidate. I am suspending my campaign. I think the voters who are the most remarkable people on the planet have been really clear that they're telling me not now, Tim. I don't think they're saying, Trey, no, but I do think they're saying not now. And so I'm going to respect the voters, and I'm going to hold on and keep working really hard and look forward to another opportunity.
Well, he's going to be set till 2028. He's got a good Senate job and gets to keep a lot of that money for his campaign, maybe for a future campaign. Byron York, chief political correspondent, Washington Examiner, Fox News contributor, will be joining me at 34 after to talk about that and Washington, D.C. going to hell as now the president's granddaughter just thwarted, thanks to the Secret Service, would-be carjacking. You listen to The Brian Kilmeade Show. Next, Ryan Mannion.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
On October 28th, Matthew Perry, who will forever be remembered for his portrayal of the lovable and wisecracking Chandler Bing on Friends, was found dead in his Los Angeles area home.
Matthew was arguably one of the biggest actors in the late 90s and early 2000s, but his rise to Hollywood stardom was not easy. From struggles with alcohol and drug addiction to feelings of loneliness and isolation.
But in the days before his death, Perry was in good spirits. By all accounts, the actor was the happiest he's ever been and had decided to devote his life to helping others. So, what happened?
We're examining the final moments of Matthew Perry's life in the latest episode of the Last Days podcast. Last Days, Matthew Perry. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and all podcast platforms.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Ryan Mannion is the president of the Travis Mannion Foundation and has dedicated her life to supporting our nation's military veterans and families of the fallen heroes. She does it in honor of her brother, First Lieutenant Travis Mannion, U.S. Marines, who made the ultimate sacrifice in Alhambra Province of Iraq while drawing fire from his wounded comrades. That was back in April 29, 2007, and there's still firing going on there today. Ryan Mannion, welcome.
Thanks so much, Brian.
So, Ryan, first off, what does Veterans Day mean to you this weekend?
You know, I come from a proud heritage of veterans. My dad, my grandfather was a part of the Army Air Corps. He was a navigator on B-17s. My dad is a retired Marine Corps colonel. Of course, my brother was a first lieutenant in the Marine Corps. And so we have a proud heritage of military service in my family. And I think, you know, Veterans Day and Veterans Day weekend is a time to remember that and honor those sacrifices and that service. And, you know, I just have a deep appreciation for anyone who steps forward to serve and protect our country.
Why'd your brother join?
I mean, you know, I'd like to say that we look at it now, you know, of course he was embedded with the Marine Corps tradition. We grew up in a military family, born on military bases. So I think, you know, just being around these proud Marines and seeing their service, it was what eventually led him to joining the Marine Corps.
Brian, can you bring me back that day in 2007? Tell our audience what your brother did.
Sure. On April 29, 2007, my brother was out on patrol with his team of Marines. They were ambushed, and two of my brother's teammates were hit. My brother exposed himself to enemy fire twice to pull his two wounded teammates to safety, and he exposed himself for a third time to push back the enemy, and it was at that time that he was shot and killed. He was the only member of his patrol that gave his life that day and received a Silver Star for his actions. And you know, the last sentence of his citation reads that his deliberate actions ultimately saved the lives of every member of his patrol. And so we have a deep sense of pride for what he did and what he represents to this greater military community.
So last year, you authored the book, The Knock at the Door, Three Gold Star Families Bonded by Grief and Purpose. So you launched that book. What was the feedback you got?
The feedback has been tremendous. You know, I wrote that book with Heather Kelly, who lost her husband, Robert Kelly, General Kelly's daughter-in-law. And, you know, we've traveled around the country just making sure that people understand what a Gold Star family is, first and foremost, because the fact of the matter is most people don't know. And bringing education to that, but also making sure that people understand that, you know, we got a literal knock at the door where Marines came to our door to share with us the worst news of our life. But the fact of the matter is that every single one of us is going to get a knock on the door. Maybe it's not going to be in the same way we got it, but there's going to be a moment that changes the course and the direction of your life. And, you know, we wanted to share our story to share with others how you can be prepared for when those moments hit.
Ryan Mannion talking about the men and women who serve, her brother in particular. You've also launched a podcast. When you open up and you talk to different people, how damaging was it the way we left Afghanistan for the men who sacrificed so much there? I know your brother died in Iraq, but still, it's so many did both.
You know, the withdrawal in Afghanistan was a colossal disaster. There's no other way to put it. I have had the unique opportunity of, I had friends over there, Afghans, who now live in my small town in Pennsylvania, a couple miles away, and to watch the devastation that was brought on to the Afghan people for this commitment. And what it gets back to for me, honestly, is we made a commitment to our Afghan allies, and we did not honor that commitment. Well, certainly our government did not honor that commitment. I think there were a lot of well-meaning groups and individuals and our service members that wanted to honor that commitment, but it wasn't done. And it's a stain on the 20 years that we were there trying to help the Afghans. And what is happening there right now, you know, it's gone and passed, but what is happening with the Afghan people now is terrible to see. They are living in refuge. They can't work. Their rights have been stripped away, and they're living in fear. And then we have 80,000 or 60 or 80,000 Afghan refugees over here that are still fighting to just get the privileges to obtain citizenship here. And it's a bureaucratic nightmare. I could go on and on, but it was a sad time for our nation's history.
I worry about the people that sacrificed and have some wounds, visible or not visible, and that feel as though it wasn't worth it. And for 20 years, we showed everybody, you guys showed everyone, or they showed everybody, that we're not here to take their land. We're here to help them stand up an army and live on their own. And for 20 years, women had actual rights. And to sort of leave that behind is insane. I just hope people listening right now do not think their sacrifice was worthless, because it means a lot. You can't control what idiotic decisions politicians to make. Your final thought on that, Ryan?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, our men and women who raise their right hand, they're not sitting around the table making those decisions, but they're the ones that are ready to carry out every mission that's given to them. And so, you know, our government has an obligation to make those decisions wisely and to do the right thing. And, you know, that wasn't done the right way, and it's a shame. But again, none of our service members over this last 20 years served in vain. Their service meant something, and we should all be so very proud of them.
Right, and they're being called to action again. We lost 5 over the weekend just in a training mission. Nothing routine about it. In-flight refueling on a Black Hawk. We lost 5 special operators. Ryan, thanks so much. I don't have to tell you. Where do we go if we want to help out?
You can head over to travismannion.org and join our mission.
Thanks. That's M-A-N-I-O-N. Ryan Mannion, thank you so much. When we come back, Byron York.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
There's just a lot of concern about the age issue. And that is something that I think he needs to ponder. Just do a check and say, is this the right thing to do? Time is fleeting here, and this is probably the last moment for him to do that check. And it's probably good if he does.
So David Axelrod, for the third time in 4 days, politely saying that Joe Biden shouldn't run. It's noteworthy. Tim Ryan, also former congressman, tried to be governor. Didn't work. He said, love Joe Biden, should not run. Van Jones doesn't look like he doesn't believe that President Biden should run. But President Biden does think he should run. Byron York knows it. Chief political correspondent, Washington Examiner, Fox News contributor. Byron, I want to get to Tim Scott's decision, but I wanted you to just comment on the reelection mode. Now it's Joe Biden's camp says, the White House says he's in reelection mode now. What's your reaction? Because the voices on the left are pretty stark.
Well, it's obvious that he's in reelection mode. Look, I've been saying this a long time. It's extremely hard to dislodge a president of your own party out of his office if he wants to seek reelection. Really, really hard to do that, and Biden has determined to do that. You do have some truthsayers out there who say, look, this is a problem. The president is too old. By the way, he's going to be 81 a week from today. I'm not sure if you've seen it yet. There's kind of a devastating piece in Politico about Biden today. Almost all of the piece is talking to Democrats about what Biden needs to do. He needs to do this. He needs to do that. He needs to hire this person or that person. But in the beginning of the piece, it says 2024 will be an extraordinary election. It demands extraordinary measures. That's in part for reasons Biden refuses to accept his capacity to do the job. The oldest president in history, when he first took the oath, Biden will not be able to govern and campaign in the manner of previous incumbents. He simply does not have the capacity to do it, and his staff doesn't trust him to even try. That's the fact. That is the fact we were facing in this campaign. And the rest of the article, I want to make clear, is a lot of Democrats offering their advice about how to reelect this man they know is not up to the job.
Which is crazy. Did you watch him on the wreath ceremony over the weekend on the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier?
Yeah.
I mean, he walked out. He sits there. He comes back. He looks at the soldier. The soldier has to point him back to the line?
We see this every day. Any American who has an aging relative, and that's probably most Americans, has seen the aging relative just slow down in front of their very eyes. Doesn't mean they have dementia, doesn't mean they have Alzheimer's. They're just slowing down, and they're no longer able to operate at the level they did before. That's clearly what's going on with the president. You see it every day, and it's the one thing in life that you can predict will not change. He's not getting any younger.
So we'll see what happens, because like you said, if he wants to run, he's going to run. He does not have to debate, but he does have a lot of different parties getting in. Cornel West, not on the Green Party. Jill Stein is. Cornel wants to keep running. RFK is out there again, 22% among independents. And then you have the no labels looking for somebody like Joe Manchin, Governor Huntsman, or Larry Hogan.
I have to say that we're talking about Biden right now, but we know that a lot of Americans are absolutely dead set on Donald Trump never being president again. And what's really extraordinary about this campaign is when you ask Americans, what are your feelings about the upcoming 2024 campaign and Joe Biden, Donald Trump rematch? Are you excited? Are you eager to get to work? Are you hopeful? And the answer that wins is dread. Dread. They don't want this choice. What that means is there has never been a better time for a third-party candidacy. Now, they don't work. I mean, in living memory, they just don't work. But given the public mood, there has never been a better time. And I think you've seen numbers from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. That are very impressive. Not that he's going to win, but that he's certainly be a big factor in the race.
Absolutely. We'll see. I mean, I'll tell you what, Trump is beating him on almost every battleground state and almost on every issue. So the question is, would abortion overwhelm it? And would people's dread for Donald Trump change things? And here's the question, Byron, and you know, Donald Trump's got flaws, but to overstate them on a daily basis is maddening. And I'm saying we know it's going to be the way, it's going to change the world. If you elect Donald Trump, the world will change. You're electing Hitler. And sure enough, I look at Mediaite coming up here. Joe Scarborough and John Meacham directly equate Trump's vermin speech to Nazism.
Yeah.
Already. Nazism already.
Well, that's been going on for quite a while. And I have to say, the two issues that matter the most right now, factors, are Biden's age and the cost of living, the result of the inflation that came when Biden became president. Those are the two biggest animating issues there. And the only way Democrats cannot come out and say, oh, the economy is really good. You know, all that anger and insecurity you felt going to the grocery store, you know, you didn't really feel that. The economy's doing great. They cannot make that argument. All they can do is talk about the threat of MAGA. And I think you're going to see just a full-blown fear campaign. Nothing. We're not seeing any of it right now so far. If Trump is the nominee, which is not guaranteed, but if he is, I think you're going to see a fear-mongering campaign about Trump, and not just about Trump, because if Trump is not the nominee, they're going to call whichever Republican is the nominee, they're going to call them MAGA and a Trump-lite and all of that stuff. So I think that's the only way Democrats can win the election.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I know you're right, because look at the way they went after DeSantis initially. And they would remember, I will never forget the way they vilified Mitt Romney. And yet Harry Reid come out and go, yeah, I made it up about, yeah, everybody knows Mitt Romney doesn't pay any taxes. What?
Yeah.
Oh, I made that up. Did he win? Okay. That was mild compared to what else they did. They made him an unelectable person who doesn't like minorities, likes to buy companies and fire people. And okay, you might want to run on something positive. But that's not what they're going to do. So hopefully Trump, we'll see if people are going to overreact to that, or have they become almost fatigued. How many times can you call someone a Nazi before you stop listening to them?
That's a good question. Maybe we need to do an experiment. It's going to be called the 2024 campaign.
So I want you to do what Tim Scott said last night. Cut 25.
One of the things I would recommend to every single American, I know it's not possible, by the way, if you ever want to love your country more, run for president. Traveling this country, meeting people has been one of the most fantastic experiences of my entire life. I love America more today than I did on May 22nd. But when I go back to Iowa, it will not be as a presidential candidate.
So he's out. Now, look, it's not like the front runner left, but he's a popular guy that had a lot of money behind him and is not waiting for another debate. Your reaction?
I think this falls into the category of shocked but not surprised.
Yeah.
Jarring that he did it last night. I mean, that he did it when he did it, because he does have the money to hang around for a good bit longer. But not surprising, because he just wasn't going anywhere in the race. Tim Scott is extremely well liked by everybody. You know, if you go to South Carolina and talk to a lot of Republicans, they say, oh, you know, I really like Nikki Haley, but I love Tim Scott. I mean, you know, he's just somebody people like. That was the holding in Iowa. By the way, as we speak, Tim Scott is in fourth place in Iowa, which is, you know, not
single digits,
totally out of it.
Yeah.
But he clearly just wasn't going anywhere, and you saw it. You saw it beginning in Milwaukee, August 23rd, the first Fox News debate. He just disappeared. He wasn't really there. He was viewed as obviously this is a crazy race. There's a top tier and just one person in it. But he was viewed as a part of that second tier, and he just didn't show up. And things didn't really get better in the second debate. And then in the third debate we just had in Miami, he kind of disappeared again. He had a way of talking, of taking up some time, but not really telling you anything. So This was a candidacy in which he was the candidate was personally popular, personally liked.
Right.
But nobody ever thought, you know, he really should be president.
But Byron, you write in your that really the debates have reached a dead end because Donald Trump's not there, and he's up by so much in the polls. In what respect do you fully feel it's a dead end?
Well, it's a dead end because the stakes are lower. Because when the prohibitive front runner skips all the debates are just arguments between a bunch of people over second place. And so the idea of the front runner, you know, on a high wire act, you know, being attacked from all sides, that's not happening because Trump is not on stage. And when I say people are fighting it out for second place, I don't mean they're fighting it out because they want to be Trump's vice presidential nominee. I don't think he'd pick any of them. What they want to do is they want to be ready in case Trump fails, in case something happens with all the legal cases against him, something happens with something else, but for some reason Trump doesn't become the nominee, somebody's going to be the nominee, and they want to be in position for that. So what you're really seeing is this race for backup. You know, I want to be the backup. No, I want to be the backup. And it's just not as compelling as an actual presidential race. So that's why I said they've kind of reached a dead end, because they have until maybe that time comes in which Donald Trump actually does take part in a debate.
The other thing is simmering beneath the surface is the Republicans are struggling. From the midterms to the off year, they have not had success, and it seems to be all about abortion. Vivek blames Ronna McDaniel. Cut 27.
I think that it's shameful that, you know, the untruths coming from Ronna McDaniel, the leader of the RNC, who has deflected accountability for her personal failures. She took over in 2017, in 2018, 2020, 2022, and 2023. We have disastrous results from the party, and yet she's looking to blame everybody but herself. Where's the accountability?
You think it's right to blame her?
In part, yeah. You have a head of the RNC, and you've just had that record that Ramaswamy mentioned, although we should remember that Republicans won control of the House in 2022. And the reason they were fighting over who would be the Speaker is because they had the majority. On the other hand, it's not a record that would really, in the past, I think, earn you re-election as chair of the RNC. I mean, they kicked out Michael Steele after the party won 63 seats to take control of the House in 2010. So her, you know, continued presence in that role is a little bit mysterious. She's well liked. She raises a lot of money, but the party has not done extremely well. Abortion is a problem, and God knows that is not Ronna McDaniel's fault. I mean, there's this huge situation in which conservatives had for two generations tried to overturn Roe v. Wade, and clearly had never really planned for what would happen if they succeeded. It's the biggest dog that caught the car problem in the history of the world, that they didn't really think about what would happen with the abortion issue after Roe was struck down. So is Ronna McDaniel like the biggest single factor in all this? I don't think so. I was surprised by Ramaswamy's personal attack on her. On the other hand, I would not be surprised at all if the Republican National Committee chose a new chair at some point, because that's generally what they do when the party has not had a good record.
Harmeet Dillon was the only one to run against her.
Yeah, and it wasn't even close. So what can you say? I think, you know, if Trump becomes the nominee, then, you know, we'll have to see what the nominee, he becomes the face of the party, the official face of the party, and we'll have to see what happens.
Ironically, perhaps, in my view, the celebrity would actually get reelected. If he does get reelected, he would get reelected on his policies, because the thing that's making Donald Trump seem right to many, and maybe open to independents or undecideds, is that from the border to the economy to international relations to interest rates on down, everything seems to have been better under Trump.
Yeah. That is the absolute bedrock under these results that we have from the New York Times poll of the six swing states in which Trump is leading Biden in five of them. Everybody said that things were better when Trump was president. They've gotten worse since Biden became president. And other than abortion, they don't trust Biden to handle anything better than Trump. So if you go to Trump's events, that is his fundamental message. You know, in news coverage, you only get some snippet of this or that. But his fundamental message was, things were good when I was president. They've gone to hell since Joe Biden became president. Elect me, and I'll make them good again. I mean, that's his fundamental appeal. And a lot of voters accept that.
And it's not theory. You could point to the record. So, Byron York, always great to get your instant analysis on this breaking news. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. I'll come back with some thoughts and hopefully your phone calls. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Lester Holt, and welcome to the Republican Kids Table Debate. Mr. Scott, anything you'd like to add?
I have a girlfriend.
Okay.
Listen, about her, she is real, and I know her, and she is my girlfriend, and we met through dating, and for her, I feel a real sense of human love.
Got it.
So that was the cold open, no doubt about it. They used the debates and had Trump walk out there. I'll tell you, I like this guy better than Alec Baldwin, but they took a shot at Tim Scott, who is now out. So let me see. Let's take a look at the debate stage. You got, for sure, DeSantis. For sure, Haley. I assume for sure, Vivek. I assume. So, yeah, here's who's in. So Nikki Haley, Vivek is in. So it's Vivek, Nikki, Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump. The question is, you have Chris Christie and Doug Burgum. Burgum is not getting anything, but the polling, it looks like Christie's there. The money goals, and Christie runs a tight ship. The question is, will Democrats and other people that just – Chris Christie's just great on these debates. I don't care if you're voting for him or not. I don't care if you dislike him. You cannot tell me that he does not add to the debates and can't handle any topic, just was over in Israel. Prior to that, went to meet with Zelensky over in Ukraine. So I think that if Chris Christie gets the dollars, I think a lot of Democrats will pour some money into Christie's campaign because they want to see him to stay on there to see if they can last as long to get Donald Trump back in. Because Governor Christie goes after Trump a lot. But he actually has a real broad swath of things he knows. Hey, go to BrianKilmeade.com. You can order my new book, Teddy and Booker T.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Michael Goodwin standing by. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, around the world. We know the big trial for Trump is on today, the civil trial, and it's a joke. You know how I feel about it. I think you probably feel the same way. But now the defense gets a chance to go on the offense. Don Jr. on the stand. Looks like his dad will be going again. Ivanka obviously won't. That won't be a choice. Eric will go back and just try to say, what the hell is going on here? And it's not affecting the polls. If anything, it's just helping. We also are looking into the possibly attempted carjacking of the granddaughter of President Biden, Naomi Biden. Not successful, but believe it or not, Secret Service shot at the guy and they got away. Douglas Murray, as I mentioned at the bottom of the hour, fresh off his trip to Israel. Let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
On Saturday, Speaker Mike Johnson presented a funding plan, and he essentially kind of came up with a two-step plan, which is the only difference from how Kevin McCarthy did it. His suggestion is for Pelosi-level spending.
Well, there you go. Not look like where we have gotten to that impasse again. Coming up in 4 days, we are going to see the end of the budget. Are we going to see a shutdown, lockdown? Well, it turns out Olivia Beavers of Politico Sites that the new speaker wants to do what the old speaker did, a continuing resolution. The last time they did that, they lost their job.
Number two.
When I go back to Iowa, it will not be as a presidential candidate. I'm suspending my campaign. I think the voters have been really clear that they're telling
2024, a major name drops out of the GOP race, Ted Race, Tim Scott. Biden moves to re-election mode, skeptics surge.
Number one.
I don't think it will be enough to deter Iran. I think Iran sees great value in stretching U.S. forces. Look, we've deployed two carrier groups, Patriot missiles and aircraft to the region, and that's exactly what Iran wants, as well as their allies, Russia and China.
There you go. Israel at war and America at risk. After 46 attacks, we have a series of return fire attacks over in Syria. We blew up a training area and we blew up a depot. Will they get the message? That was Dan Hoffman. Michael Goodwin joins us on New York Post columnist. So, Michael, we finally hit back. 46 attacks, countless TBI complaints from the troops after the explosions, been knocked out by, we think, mostly missile defense, some of them one-way drones. But for the most part, they tried to send a message. So far, no return fire. But after the first retaliation, there were four attacks. Your reaction to for what's happening in Syria and Iraq to our guys?
Well, Brian, I think if we step back from the tit-for-tat kind of approach to this, I think what we're seeing in the region is a real move now by all of the bad guys against Israel and the United States. It seems to me that, for example, Hezbollah in the north of Israel has stepped up over the weekend its missiles and rockets into Israel. So that front is heating up. Meanwhile, while you still have the main story in Gaza with the Israeli defense forces. But when you see these ancillary groups around the fringes, the Houthis in Yemen, for example, and in Syria, when you see them chipping in to fire at America and our bases and our service people there, it says to me that this is not over. This could go either way. And it seems to me that they are pushing in a way that forces us to respond, because if we don't, they will just keep upping the ante. So we've got to respond and at least test, you know, let them know we're capable of wiping you out if we really want to do it. So don't play that game, you know, the old Clint Eastwood, you know, make my day. But I think Biden has been too cautious. I understand you don't want to inflame these things further. But at the same time, unless you respond in a forceful way, yeah, they're going to keep pricking at you and trying to test you and embarrass you and maybe hurt your service people. They're going to raise their profile until we smash it. That's my fear, that they are not going to stop until we stop them.
Right. I don't think there's any question about it. And I think now that he's getting some pressure because he's seeing that his Muslim base, his left-wing base, his Palestinian base, pro-Hamas base, is starting to question him. And he's actually doing the right thing. So, again, splitting the difference. Listen to Jay Johnson, his Homeland Security Secretary, on Meet the Press yesterday. Cut six.
If the reporting is to be believed, civilian deaths in Gaza are about to become 10 times the number of Israeli deaths on October 7th. Prime Minister said that the Israeli Defense Forces are not targeting civilians. Of course they're not targeting civilians. No one really believes that they're targeting civilians. However, you can target the enemy, the terrorist, and have a callous disregard for civilian deaths and violate the laws of armed conflict. And that's the rising concern across the globe right now. I give the administration, the Biden administration, a lot of credit for firmly standing behind Israel right after October 7th, but also publicly and privately warning the government of Israel about civilian casualties, about possibility of...
So that's what they're doing. Yeah, well, they've been asking them to pull back, but I don't think they fully understand. There can't be a tomorrow with Hamas.
And also, Jay Johnson is usually more sensible than that.
I agree.
And look, Israel can't win in the court of public opinion. And so this idea that if Israel just behaves better, anti-Semitism is not about Israel behaving. It's not about the Jewish nation's borders. It is about Judaism. It is about Jews. And that's what the world is facing. And I think that what America needs to do is remove the daylight between the United States and Israel. Israel is fighting a war of survival. This is not adventuresome. This is not a cowboy thing. They are fighting a war of survival. And the world, of course, much of the world, is happy for that. It would love to see Israel wiped off the map. You know, someone sent around, Brian, something over the weekend about the number of deaths in Darfur, the number of deaths in Ukraine. Why they dwarf anything that's happened in Gaza by ordinary 10, 12, 15 times, and yet no one is saying Ukraine shouldn't fight back. No one is questioning how many Russians Ukraine kill. They're practically celebrated in the New York Times. But when Israel fights back, when Israel looks like it's about to win, suddenly, oh, no, no, we have to worry about the civilians. Well, the civilians are there because Hamas wants them there. This is how Hamas fights. And to pull Israel back is to give Hamas the victory. Hillary Clinton understood that in the beginning, but everybody gets worn down by this criticism. Thankfully, Israel is not worn down by it because it's got to eradicate Hamas. It's got to finish the job. And if it doesn't, there will be another October 7th and another and another. That's what this is about. This is not the same tit for tat that happened every couple of years. This is a final battle that Hamas started and wants. And Israel should give it what it wants, which is death.
Right. And the thing is that everyone has in the back of their mind the hostages, at least 9 are American, one of which is a 3-year-old whose parents were just killed. Think about how beyond evil these jihadists are. So think about that the next time they're protesting at the University of Pennsylvania or Tulane, which, by the way, is not Tulane students. I know that for certain. People coming from the outside, or Harvard or Yale or Columbia. Think about that. The other thing I'm heartened by is people like real estate billionaire Barry Sternlicht. I don't know him, but evidently he's upset. He's Jewish, and he can't believe these schools are supporting Hamas. So he's given $50 million and going on a media campaign targeting Hamas. And he wants the media, he wants the pushback, and he's putting his money behind it. Rather than just keeping these colleges from getting donations, take that money and put it to selling the real story here.
You know, Brian, I think what has happened on our college campuses has been a very unpleasant shock to a lot of us. I mean, the raw anti-Semitism that was apparently hiding itself in most cases is now front and center. It can't be ignored, and you can't just put it back in the box. This is now a fact that's got to be dealt with. And I think for Sternlicht to do what he's doing, I mean, many, many donors are no longer giving to the universities. I only give to my school's baseball team because I played baseball, and so that's the only donations I would make to my school. But look, I think that what we've seen now is shocking. And it's just got to – it can't be rewarded. It can't be ignored. It's got to be dealt with. And many of these college presidents are afraid of their students. They're afraid of the radicals on their own campus.
They don't want to get fired either.
And well, that's right. And the boards of trustees are afraid. You know, it's like they put their finger in the wind and see which way the wind is blowing, and that's the way they go. I think it's going to take a lot of backbone from a lot of adults to set this straight. But I am not confident because we have raised a bunch of brats who think they are entitled even though they're ignorant. And I think that's one of the great one of the great revelations of this time is that our generations have failed in the sense that we have raised, these are our kids. This is the fruit of American generations, that we have raised these kids who don't know right from wrong, and who think that they should run the institutions they're in.
Real quick, I want to talk about what they're doing. So President Biden looks like he's going to run again. He's trailing with Trump on every issue in every battleground state. So I predicted, like you would have, that they're going to vilify Trump and say not that he'll be a bad president, he will change democracy, he'll destroy the country. And sure enough, I go to Mediaite. Joe Scarborough and John Meacham directly equate Trump's vermin speech to Nazism. And I'm seeing that the same thing for the Washington Post yesterday when they talk about an excerpt from the speech that they didn't like. And you have Jamie Raskin. He will destroy the country if he gets reelected. If they are doing this in November when it's 1 year away, what are they, is it going to be like if he ends up being the nominee? Here's a little of Jamie Raskin, cut 31.
The role of the government, in his view, is to advance his political fortunes and destroy his political enemies. So what would a second term look like? It would look a lot like Vladimir Putin in Russia. It would look a lot like Viktor Orban in Hungary.
Right. Or Nazism with John Meacham, who's trying to tell Joe Biden that he's FDR. So what is your take on this? How much worse can it get?
I first, Brian, I would just say that I regret ever thinking John Meacham was a serious historian. Second, Hillary Clinton went all the way last week. She said Hitler.
Yeah.
She's another Hitler. After you've said that, what else is there to say?
I know.
There's nowhere to go. So I think that this will not be effective. I think it's so clearly overwrought and so hyperinflated with their own hatred of him. And the other thing is Jamie Raskin is on the Oversight Committee in the House. He's been the main voice defending Biden against the impeachment inquiry. And he said something last week which is just astounding, that there's zero evidence that Joe Biden was involved in his son's business or ever made any money from it. Now, this in the same week that James Comer showed $240,000 worth of payments to Joe Biden. Now, as Comer says, the payments from Jim Biden were both labeled loan repayment. But he's asked the White House for evidence that a loan was ever made. They refused to give an answer. I think they refused to give an answer because there never was a loan made, and there's tax implications. Mm-hmm. But as Comer says, this proves, even if it was a loan repayment that was made because Jim and Hunter Biden got a lot of money from China, that proves that Joe Biden profited from these transactions. And so if that's not impeachment inquiry material, and by the way, this happened when he was vice president. So if that's not impeachment material, I don't know what is. And I think if people like Raskin want to have any credibility left, they're going to have to get on the stick here and acknowledge that facts are facts.
Right. Michael Goodwin, thanks so much. New York Post, that's where to read them. Thanks, Michael.
My pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
At @mgoodwin_NY Post. Listen, we come back. I'm going to squeeze in some of your calls. I saw a lot of you over the weekend. My book tour has begun. I was in Ponte Vedra, at the Villages, at Vero Beach. And I was great seeing everybody again. I've been out in a year being able to talk to people at that level. And then we got the Patriot Awards. I'll be signing there, then going over to Tennessee and Alabama. Just go to BrianKilmeade.com. So this way I could see you in person. More on that in just a moment. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Tuskegee in particular becomes a place where politicians want to go. McKinley, Grover Cleveland, William Howard Taft, and of course Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Here you have this, a black male born into slavery, who grows to a level where he becomes an advisor to three presidents. The man was a genius. He was able to prove that the American dream is actually possible. That's what really catapulted him into the national stage. because he said if we work together, we can have our differences. I recognize you have a difference and I recognize I have a difference. But progress is mutual.
The revolutionary message was first heard at the 1895 Cotton States and International Exposition in Atlanta, looking to not only advance his institute, but the perception of his race. Booker T. Washington became the first African-American male to address a crowd as diverse as his country. Well, that was just a clip from a Fox Nation special that is available now. Hopefully it'll be on the channel shortly. Teddy and Booker T., how two American icons blaze the path to racial equality. I really enjoyed seeing everyone in Ponte Vedra and work with our great affiliate, WOKV, and also be able to go to the villages and see our fan base over there was fantastic. It just gets bigger every time. And then to Vero Beach, to their independent bookstore out there. So I got a chance to meet a lot of you, saw you in action. And I have to say, I came back, I kind of forgot it was fall/winter, 32 degrees. So from 88 to 32, 50 degrees, back in action. This morning, I started up the car, getting set to go to the train station, and there's frost on the windows. I can't believe it's the same country, but I should not act surprised that fall is here and it's just not acknowledged out in Florida. So listen, when we come back, Douglas Murray joins me where he just spent some time is really what the whole country's been thinking about and acting it. Douglas Murray just spent some time in Israel, talked to all the officials, went to where the massacre took place, where the wall was breached over in Gaza. And you saw what was left of the kibbutzes, those small towns and the people. Now the number's down to 1,200 lives lost. 700 plus are civilians. And we have at least 244 hostages. We'll see about getting them back.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
But those who protest for Hamas, you're protesting for sheer evil. There are a lot of misguided people out there who don't know the facts. You're talking to people who deliberately targeted civilians, who raped and murdered women, who raped, who beheaded men, who burnt babies alive, who kidnapped little babies and hostage and Holocaust survivors. You name it. These are the people that you're supporting.
That is Benjamin Netanyahu, who's doing a lot more interviews these days and over the weekend. And he puts himself out there, and every interview ends this way. Are you going to take responsibility for what happened? And a lot of people think his political career is over. The parliamentary system is not something we deal with, but it's something that could collapse their government. But right now, it's all about coming together. That's what I hear. But what does Douglas Murray know? He's in Tel Aviv right now, Fox News contributor, best-selling author, National Review Institute fellow. His new book is The War on the West. His latest book is The War on the West. Douglas, I hear you're in traffic in Tel Aviv. That would be a prime target for Hezbollah, who I understand is ratcheting up the rockets.
Yes, that's right. There's been more and more activity on the northern border in recent days, which is obviously causing a lot of alarm. Israel is currently fighting, obviously, a very intense house-to-house battle inside Gaza against Hamas. But, of course, all eyes are also on the northern border, where there has been, as I say, an increase in activity, some anti-tank artillery, machine gun fire, as well as rockets. And, of course, that's a great concern to the Israeli government and the people of Israel, because Hezbollah has tens of thousands of rockets stored there.
They do. But there's a sense, too, I imagine, you tell me, that Hezbollah is only going to get stronger. And this country's at war, on a war footing right now. Is there any part of the Israel IDF that thinks to themselves, should we just get this over with now?
I'm sure there are. And there's obviously a wide variety of opinion. I think most people are grateful that the Northern Front hasn't opened up. And it's an interesting scenario because, of course, Iran has a great deal to do with the funding and arming of not just Hezbollah, but Hamas as well. It seems that they haven't, as it were, tried to come to Hamas's aid by making the situation harder for Israel by opening the Northern Front. But that sort of
quite commonplace for Iran's behavior, which is that the revolutionary government both keeps proxies going and also sacrifices them as needs be.
How would you describe everything, Douglas? You've been to war zones. You were just in Ukraine a short time ago. Were you one and checked out the war, the side of the invasion where the massacre took place? What could you tell our listeners?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that as I wrote in the New York Post the other day, the world really still needs to know a lot more and to realize a lot more about the horror that unfolded on the morning of the 7th of October. It was a massacre, I think, unprecedented in recent history for its barbarism, for its scale, for the sheer sadistic glee that the Hamas terrorists took in the most atrocious acts of evil. And I think that because, as always happens in any war involving Israel, people move straight on to what will the Israeli response be. The world hasn't actually spent enough time, no one's had enough time, to look at, uncover, and realize actually what happened that day, because it was a battalion-sized attack of terrorists on Israel that day, from sea, air, land. They went as deep into the country as they could, and I've both seen the sites of the massacres and spent part of today talking with survivors and also the families of people who were kidnapped by Hamas and were taken into Gaza. And that's a really, as you just heard from the Prime Minister's comments, so that's the scale of that is something that really would horrify people. I spoke earlier to a man who's almost in his entire family, including all the young children, were kidnapped and have been taken into Gaza. Nobody knows if they're alive, if they're well. I spoke to another young woman who not only had her cousin abducted, kidnapped and taken into Gaza by Hamas, but also her grandmother, who's in her 80s, has serious health issues, can't even get to the bathroom on her own. And Hamas kidnapped her, and there's footage of them gleefully taking this 80-something-year-old woman on a golf cart and taking her into Gaza, and just so happy about doing so, so happy about violating and abducting and a helpless old woman. It really is something which I think it's enough to shock even those of us who think we can't be shocked that much.
How about the fact that among those things, and those are horrific, we find out that a 3-year-old American kid, 3 years old, whose parents were killed in front of him, is also there. So one of nine. And most of these people, are, I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. Take as much as you can. And we know more of the game plan. The game plan was to go deeper into Israel and kill more people in the most horrific way imaginable.
Well, Hamas's leaders have said that in recent days, which is if they get the chance, they plan to do this again and again and again. And that's why I think there's an extraordinary unity in Israel. Israel has obviously been a very divided country in recent times. Every country has divisions, as we all know. But when a country faces an atrocity like that, it really can come together. And Israel really has. And it's remarkable to see the young men and women and people of all ages doing whatever it is they can do to help their country and help their country win at this time.
Yes. This is a bigger question, Douglas. There's a big push now for a ceasefire, for a pause, to make sure there's too many civilian casualties. In fact, here is Emmanuel Macron, cut one.
I think this is the only solution we have, this ceasefire, because it's impossible to explain. We want to fight against terrorism by killing innocent people. De facto, today, civilians are bombed. De facto, these babies, these ladies, these old people are bombed and killed.
Okay, that is true, but never the intention. Emmanuel Macron says it's time to pull back. Do you get any of that when you leave the country? You've heard of that when you leave the country or read press from other nations, right? What is the right thing to do?
Well, what's very striking is that European leaders in particular and American leaders to some extent are being pressured to call for these ceasefires. And there have been the announcement of sort of four-hour pauses is what the Israeli government is saying. It seems that the Israeli government was pushed into this actually not by Macron, but by President Biden.
and that they couldn't resist the political pressure which came from him to have these pauses. What's striking about it, of course, is that the Israelis are trying to move in and put a stranglehold on Hamas and the Gaza. And any ceasefire, any let-up of that is, of course, only going to help Hamas. Macron is an interesting case because, of course, he's saying this for domestic political reasons. Don't forget, not only have they had huge protests on the streets of Paris and other cities in support of the Palestinians in recent weeks, but also, of course, Macron banned protests, and yet they went ahead. So this is a very, very tense situation for France, as it is for America. This conflict in Israel, this attack on Israel by Hamas, has opened up serious fault lines in our own societies, in France, in Britain, in America, in campuses in America, on the streets of America. And as I've said since this conflict began, Israel can and should look after itself. But we in America and in other countries in the West have to look after ourselves as well, because the same hatred is in our midst.
Look at the size of these crowds and these protests for Hamas, for the Palestinians. Now, there's going to be a huge pro-Israeli rally in Washington, D.C. I hope it's a pushback. I hope a lot of these donors start advertising and getting the word out about who the bad guys are. But here's a bigger question, Douglas. Is it possible to win a war the way we used to win wars in World War II? Did we worry about civilians in Berlin? Did we worry about civilians in Nagasaki and Hiroshima? Will we attack first? Did we have a choice? We had to win. If you have to win a war, you do it?
Israel is the only country in the world that is expected to give fuel and other necessities to its enemies in a war. There's huge international opprobrium for Israel not giving enough electricity supplies to Hamas. I don't know of another conflict in history in which people were expected to help their enemies to this extent. But the bigger question, the bigger picture on this, Brian, and I don't need to tell you this, but this might be interesting for some listeners, is that the atrocities in October were so appalling against Israel that it doesn't matter whether you're on the right or the left, pro-Netanyahu or anti-Netanyahu, the revulsion is so complete. And I mean, I just literally now was in the car back from a trauma hospital a recovery unit where I was speaking with a very hard interview to do, I have to say, with a father in one of the kibbutz, one of the communities near Gaza that was attacked. And he lost his wife and 14-year-old son who died beside him. And he said to me at the end of the interview, he said, you know, I'm of the left. Lots of people in these kibbutz around Gaza are. They're peaceniks, they're pro-peace, peace activists, pro-Palestinian, and much more. He said, I'm of the left. We cannot live with these people beside us. And I don't think there's a single person in Israel at this stage who thinks that they can. The status quo up to the beginning of October has been proven to be absolutely unlivable. And so something big will change. Israel, in my view, should be allowed to do what it needs to do to protect its citizenry. And I just hope that the rest of the civilized world, who's had little tastes of the terror that Israel had unleashed on it last month, stand behind Israel at this time of trial.
I hear you. It's just so good that you go there and you get a perspective. And the thing is, I think it was so important to point out, the people that they killed were the most sympathetic for the Palestinian cause and for Hamas. A lot of them were volunteers. These people that went to a concert were the least threatening to Hamas or a Palestinian in Israel, and they're the ones who were the initial victims. And then it went into the military and beyond. Douglas, I look forward to catching up with you when you come back.
I look forward to it too, Brian.
All right, thanks. Stay safe. 1-8-T-C. Calling us from traffic in Tel Aviv. How great is that? 1-866-408-7669. Brian Kilmeade, so glad you're here. When we come back, I get to hear from you. Don't move.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
After new polls show Donald Trump leading Joe Biden, Democratic strategists are calling Biden's re-election campaign a 5-alarm fire.
which is scary for Biden because in a fire, you have to use the stairs.
All right, that was one of the jokes that survived to help our show get better on SNL. They mocked, of course, the Republicans, but you could always, my goodness, that was a joke. But if you see the president, listen, it was Saturday, so I don't think you could do it. But here you are, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and the president of the United States puts a wreath down and then totally loses himself. He stands, he walks away, he turns back towards the soldier. The soldier has to turn him back. And then he goes way to the other side and then starts shaking people's hands after a brief pause. It's crazy that he's the president of the United States and wants four more years, and no one can really stop him. Here's Ron from WABC. Hey, Ron.
How are you?
Good. What's in your mind?
So, as usual, I usually have something to say because it's education, education, education. The fact of what our university students are not being taught, that they're coming out protesting along with other people that usually just come out to protest. But what happened with the million or so Muslims that are being concentration camp-like kept and worked to death in China? Where were they when that was going on? And that's going on right now, as a matter of fact.
Yes, Muslims.
And nothing is being said. Why aren't they? Are they not being told about it, or are they pro-China? What is going on, and why aren't they protesting about that?
People are scared to death of China. And in our country, there's Uyghurs that come out. There are Chinese Uyghurs that come out here, and there are Muslims that come out. Very small numbers. No one brings it up anymore. You just took a whole group of people, Muslims, and you put them into concentration camps and made them convert. When we were over in Afghanistan and Iraq, if we had a Quran that was caught next to a garbage pail, it was a scandal. We had to apologize for it. We even had Gitmo. But yet the Muslims have no problem. Saudi Arabia, no problem. Chinese officials want to come over. Okay. How many Muslims? A million? Okay. Concentration camps, can't get out. Forced labor, organ harvesting, doesn't matter. They're part of the hypocrisy. But, Ron, people should understand, when we get into this debate, if you're at Thanksgiving and the people start engaging you that Israel should give the Palestinians a state, Hamas does not want a state. Hamas doesn't care about Palestinians. They are jihadists. They just want to kill. They want to kill everybody. They totally intimidate the Palestinians, even in the West Bank. So that's really important, the hypocrisy here. There's no purity of thought. There's no purity of mission, not by a long shot. And that's why when people say, okay, let's go to a ceasefire, they can cease fire and leave Hamas in place. Because do you know they turn down gas and energy to fuel their hospital? The IDF risked their lives, gets to the hospital, and it was turned down by Hamas. So don't say Israel's got to show a little bit more heart when it comes to civilians. Here is Mark Short. He used to be the chief of staff for Vice President Mike Pence. Cut 7.
I think there's urgency, and I think Speaker Johnson is uniquely positioned right now in a very divided conference to help unite it and get that done. I don't know that I accept the premise, though, Kristen, your question, that the House Republicans and the people on the stage are in the same position as the Biden administration. I do think the Biden administration is getting weak-kneed on this. I think it's concerning. There's not been an attack in 80 years like this on the Israeli and Jewish people. We're seeing a rise of anti-Semitism like we have not seen, and yet the messaging is concerned about Islamophobia. I think that the reality is we need to stand with Israel right now. And I think the Republicans on that stage and Republican members of Congress are willing to do that.
Yeah, and what he was initially talking about was the funding. Funding runs out November 17th. Biden wants them both coupled, Ukraine and Israel. Senator Schumer said he's putting together a spending plan that doesn't include either. Wow. And now you have the House, who can't even agree on all their appropriations bills. I think they're up to 7. They need 10. Mike Lawler is somebody who just went over there, New York. He is in a tough blue district, but he's been so effective. I think it's a strong case for reelection. Here he is weighing in on ABC. Cut 8.
The bottom line here is, yes, we need to provide humanitarian relief, and we want to avoid civilian casualties. But this 11,000 civilian number that keeps getting repeated by the press is factually wrong. Within that number, thousands of Hamas terrorists have been killed. And obviously, Hamas is using these civilians as human shields. And so the oppressor here, the people that are responsible for the deaths in Gaza, is Hamas.
Yeah, no kidding. We got to keep that straight. I don't know why he can figure out, nobody else can. Quick note, I'm going to be signing Teddy and Booker T over in Connecticut. I'm going to be doing that tomorrow. It's a pretty deep into Connecticut, actually, but a beautiful bookstore, RJ Jeweler Booksellers. Hope to see everybody there. I start signing Madison, Connecticut, I should say. I start signing at 5 o'clock, and then I'll be in Brentwood Sen, Tennessee, November 17th at 5. Chattanooga, Tennessee, right after on the 18th, November 18th, same day. I'll go to Madison, Alabama after, Montgomery on the 19th, and Bayshore, New York on the 25th.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. This is really a hotbed of anti-Semitism. I'm embarrassed to say that. Somebody has been working here for over 25 years and live on Long Island where it's really not a problem. In fact, it was a rally for Israel yesterday. I have not heard a lot of that cropping up in New York City. It's been an embarrassment. Just as bad in the UK. I'm watching what's happening in London, seeing the chaos that's taking place there, how people could be looking at Israel as the bad guy and anti-Semitism as the reason is just beyond me. But it's got to stop, and hopefully the pushback begins tomorrow in D.C., where there's going to have the biggest Israel demonstration, they think, ever in our country. Andy McCarthy standing by. Jennifer Griffin at the bottom of the hour, the latest on this Pentagon retaliatory strikes in Syria. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
On Saturday, Speaker Mike Johnson presented a funding plan, and he essentially kind of came up with a two-step plan, which is the only difference from how Kevin McCarthy did it. His suggestion is for Pelosi-level spending.
Yep. CR time. It's true. 5 days to the shutdown. Speaker Johnson talking about CR, continuing resolution. Last speaker that brought that up. Oh, well, let me see. Oh, he was told to leave.
Number two.
When I go back to Iowa, it will not be as a presidential candidate. I am suspending my campaign. I think the voters have been really clear that they're telling me not now, Tim.
Wow. Just like that, Senator Tim Scott Sunday night on Trey Gowdy's show 2024 drops out. Biden moves to reelection mode. Skeptic surge on his left. We bring you inside the sprint to the official 24 campaign.
Number one.
I don't think it will be enough to deter Iran. I think Iran sees great value in stretching U.S. forces. Look, we've deployed two carrier groups, Patriot missiles and aircraft to the region, and that's exactly what Iran wants, as well as their allies, Russia and China.
I know Dan's the expert, but I'm not sure Iran wants a huge military presence for America. Russia and China, absolutely. Israel at war and America at risk after 46 attacks, the first return series of fires hitting strikes yesterday. No answer from the Iranian resistance, plus the future of Gaza and the protest pushback. With me right now is Andrew McCarthy, Fox News contributor, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Andy, welcome back. Okay, Andy, can you hear me?
Yeah, Brian, I'm here.
Okay, great. So, Andy, your reaction tomorrow, there's going to be some pushback, pro-Israeli movement and showing in Washington, D.C., way overdue, don't you think?
I do. I just hope it has the desired effect with our political leaders. I'm very worried, Brian, to hear Secretary Blinken over the weekend lecture Israel about civilian casualties under circumstances where everybody knew that Hamas is using civilian infrastructure, including these hospitals, to actually be where they store their arsenal and ground zero for where they conduct military operations. I mean, everybody knew that. So if you're going to lecture Israel about, you know, we don't want to see firefights in hospitals, then how are they supposed to win this thing? And I say that because unless you allow them to win, then you are going to sustain Hamas, which means you have a future of more civilian casualties. So war is terrible. The prospect of collateral damage and civilian casualties is terrible. But the reason that those civilians are trapped in that hospital is because Hamas didn't evacuate it. So it's Hamas that's responsible for these casualties. And I think our government, I hope that our government feels pressure from the broad middle of America that supports Israel and changes its tune, because I don't see how you can, if Israel doesn't win this, then we just have a future of more jihadism and civilian casualties.
Yeah, 300 liters of fuel were going to be brought to the Shifa hospital, but it was rejected. Hamas forbade the hospital from taking it. Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry has been warned for weeks that the hospitals are running out of fuel. The IDF delivered it on great risk to them, and it was rejected. What more proof do you need? They say underneath that hospital is a network of tunnels. Let's see. Hamas says, no, we don't have it there.
Right, including an American hostage. I mean, multiple American hostages, but we're now hearing that there's a toddler who's an American hostage.
Three years old.
And I have to say, Brian, you know, I'm old enough to remember how I was in college at the time, how the hostage crisis, the Iranian hostage crisis, destroyed Jimmy Carter's presidency. I mean, there were a lot of problems with it, but that was like the signal issue of the 1980 campaign. And I believe that because they worry that it will redound to Trump's benefit, that the media is not covering the fact that in addition to all the other atrocious stuff that came out of October 7th, 33 Americans were killed, which is bigger than almost most of the terrorist attacks that we've suffered since the 1980s. You have at least 10 American hostages being held, which should be, if this was a Republican administration, page one in every newspaper in America would be about
the hostage
crisis. So, you know, Iran is making war on us. We have, like, I think I saw with Brett Baer reporting last week that we've had something in the neighborhood of about four dozen attacks on American troops. I think Jennifer Griffin said, you know, 25 traumatic brain injuries.
Yep.
I mean, Iran's making war on us, and, you know, you can read about it on page 27 at the bottom of the page in the New York Times. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I know. And we answered back, and I'm going to talk to Jennifer about that in 15 minutes. We answered back with two strikes. One was a training base. The other was a depot. And there was secondary explosions, according to the video that they're showing everyone. So I'm glad they hit that. But you know where the bulk of the attacks are coming from? Iraq, 14. So they're coming at 14 in Iraq, but we're hitting Syria. Listen, I know there's real bad outfits in Syria, too. But what are we so afraid of in Iraq? We know that place like the back of our hands right now.
Yeah, well, I kind of agree with what I heard H.R. McMaster say last week, which is we have to convey to the Iranians that we know what the return address is on all these attacks. And yes, they're launching from Iraq, but I think, you know, unless the Ayatollah thinks that there's a smart bomb coming through his window, or is at least made to fear that that is a possibility, I don't think you're going to get their attention.
You know, I think that it's going to be interesting to see who stands with whom. And you have to go out there and show people the video of what happened October 7th and know that they feel as though they didn't finish the job. The game plan was to go even deeper into Israel, get more hostages, kill more people. And I go back to that intercept of that killer calling back on the Israeli who he just killed, grabbing their phone, calling back to his house saying, "Mom, I've killed Jews. I've killed Jews. I got the blood on my hand. Check out the WhatsApp. Dad, I've killed Jews. Look, listen to me. I killed Jews." And I said, "Just come home." He goes, no, I killed Jews. I swear. You make me so proud." I mean, think about that mindset.
Yeah, well, you know, the difference between today, Brian, and 30 years ago, and I'm dating myself here, but when I tried the blind sheikh and the people who bombed the World Trade Center 30 years ago now, we were able to prove in court what the ideology was that fueled these attacks. And there was no doubt about the fact that it wasn't about Zionism, it's anti-Semitism. And Jew hatred, it happens to be a fact. It's part of their doctrine. So, you know, for years we've had transnational progressives in America and around the world who want to delude themselves and the rest of us into believing that this is just a parochial political issue that's about Zionism. And in fact, it's about Jew hatred, and it's always been about Jew hatred. We knew that in the 1990s, but for some reason, we don't want to register it today.
So Chris Christie's there, and here's what he said. Cut 12.
I intend to go back to the U.S. and talk about this regularly so that the American people who are being asked to sacrifice and to help Israel financially and militarily will know that what they're doing is not only a noble effort on their part, but also what friends do for friends. And America has no greater friend in the world than Israel, and we need to make sure that we refresh that friendship at times of peril like this.
But you pointed out to this problem and this mindset in 2011. You told us you wrote a book about it. You tried to contact Senator Schumer about it, but he wasn't buying it.
Well, I think it's not this isn't a deep, dark mystery. It's just something that we don't want to grapple with. And I applaud Governor Christie for what he's doing, because really what this comes down to is, are you on the side of civilization or barbarism? You know, there are people in the government who would like you to believe that this is a parochial political dispute that's about, you know, Israel and the Palestinians and what the ultimate set, you know, what the ultimate outcome is going to be, this idea of a two-state solution. The only people interested in a two-state solution are Israel. And I imagine that they're less interested in it by the day, but the people who, you know, everybody in the world is saying, let's have a two-state solution. One side wants to destroy the other one. You can't have a two-state solution, and it's not a parochial political dispute. It's Sharia supremacist ideology that wants to wipe out what it perceives as the enemies of Islam, and it doesn't perceive anybody to be more an enemy of Islam than Jews. And that's just a fact. You know, I wish it wasn't true. I hate to be blunt to say it, but it's a doctrinal fact. And until we come to grips with it and are amenable to looking at it in the eye and understanding it needs to be destroyed, then we're going to be in this continuous loop where every 4 or 5 years we have something atrocious like this occur.
So they're trying to make heads of it. They don't understand. They have to make sure the American public is zoned in on this. They probably know that this administration's terrible communicators. They don't come off confident, and we know the president's having trouble getting out of sentence. Michael Herzog weighed in. He's the president of Israel. Cut 13.
What we see today with more and more people moving to the south indicates to us that these people do not want to serve as human shields for Hamas. They understand. They don't like us, but they don't like Hamas either.
And that Benjamin Netanyahu later on says we have to have a presence in the region, and they say, no, you don't. He's like, yeah, we do. And he says that there is no partner yet, and certainly not a boss who can't even control Ramallah. But the fact is, they say that most Palestinians know that Hamas did this. They brought it on themselves. They don't like him, but they keep voting for him, or they voted for him the only time they had a chance.
Yeah, that's right. Look, I think that part of the big problem that we have here is this democracy fetish, where it's an idea, you know, this idea that the only legitimate government is the government the people vote for. If you give that advantage to Sharia supremacists, you have what we have here, which is you had one election in the West Bank in 2005 and one election in Gaza in 2006 and never another one, because these people believe in one person, one vote, one time, and then they install Sharia and there's never another vote. So what you need to have, while hopefully democratic institutions develop over time, you need to have rulers in these places, I hate to say this, but like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, where they're authoritarian rulers, but actually civil rights in those countries do a lot better than they would under Sharia, where it's systematically discriminatory and repressive.
What do you think?
And yet we have to have democracy. We have to have people vote. But if that's where you're coming from, this is what you're going to get.
Well, a couple of things. What does it mean for the Columbias, the NYUs, the Hunter colleges that we're seeing, and that we're seeing the activism right there on campus? You said you saw that in 2011 when you wrote your book. But where is the constituency for it? I mean, there's nothing admirable about the Hamas extremist movement. I mean, I haven't heard anything about this until these October 7th attacks. Where has it been?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood started the Muslim Students Associations in the 1960s, and there was just a handful of them at first. But over time, this is now 60 years, right? So they've you now have four or five chapters in most universities in the United States and Canada, and they are the propagators not just of like Hamas jihadism, but the Muslim Brotherhood has an entire Sharia-oriented plan. In fact, I would recommend to people, Brian, that they read Ayaan Hirsi Ali's wonderful essay that she wrote over the weekend about how her life, the trajectory of her life, has changed from being steeped in radical Islam to finding Christ. And it's not – I'm not trying to make a religious point so much as I'm trying to say read what Ayaan says about how she grew up and what was drummed into her and how she was indoctrinated. And then I think you'll understand what's happening in these universities because it's the same program. It's
we had the son of Hamas on, one of the founders, and he explained it all in detail, put it in a book. They did a movie. And now he's speaking out saying, don't worry about collateral damage. You have to stop these guys. They have to die. And his dad is in prison, but he's talking about everybody his dad worked with, paid, and I guess bred, except him. Andy, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, listen, we're going to come back and take your calls, and then Jennifer Griffin on the latest couple of strikes that went into Syria to dissuade Iran's militias from attacking us. Will it work? Brian Kilmeade Show.
Educating, entertaining, enlightening. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So over the weekend, I was on with Howie Kurtz promoting the President Freedom Fighter. But, of course, we talk about what's happening in the media. More than happy to do it. Leslie Marshall on with me. And we're talking about Trump and Biden. And she's trying to say that Trump is doing just as bad as Biden in terms of memory, performance, speeches. I know his enemies are doing that on the Republican side. They're rivals, I should say, not enemies. So I want you to hear this exchange and listen to what she said. The problem is her facts are all wrong, and I'll prove it. And Rolling Stone wrote this up. We were able to get a hold of them, showed them I was right, and they fixed it to a degree. Media, I didn't, but listen. 28.
You know, this week I saw repeatedly, you know, video clip after video clip of Donald Trump's talking about the current president, Barack Obama, who is not the current president.
As it, yeah.
So, I mean, you know, we want to split these things apart. And honestly, in defense of both of them, they're human. I went into the supermarket the other day and I couldn't remember what the heck I was getting. And I'm not in my 70s yet, although
really?
I may feel it or even look it someday.
Come on,
yes,
Leslie.
Yes, yes.
There's no way that you can't compare yourself to Joe Biden. There's no way. And Donald Trump keeps saying that because he believes Obama's pulling the strings. I talked to him off camera about that. I talked to him on radio about that. I said, "Why?" And I corrected him on the radio interview. Please go back and listen. Yeah. I said, "You mean Joe Biden?" He goes, "No, Joe Biden, he's convinced Barack Obama's running the country. That's why he says it. He wants you to think that."
Oh, Brian, come on.
And he thinks that's come to on, his
that's,
advantage.
That's good. That's good. You should be his manager, his campaign
listen
manager.
Listen to the internet.
That's
okay.
A really
so,
good
So she on. Says that you should be his manager. Everyone says, "Oh, what a great comeback." We're up against a break right now, but let's listen to Cut 29. Yeah, cut play 29. I'll come out.
It's all coming through Iran, and Obama wants to. He doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to mention. He doesn't even mention them in his statements. It's all coming through Iran.
Well, you mean President Biden? So, but right
you know,
now,
I also mean Obama.
What do you mean?
I mean Obama and Biden, but Obama is Biden's boss. In case you didn't
see what I'm talking about, that's what I was referring to. That's the facts.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
We need to, one, secure the border. We need to make sure we have the backs of Ukraine, and we need to have the backs of Israel. But focus on who's supporting who. It is interesting that the Taiwanese, they want the West to help Ukraine. Why? Because they know if Ukraine wins, then China won't invade Taiwan, and we won't have to deal with that. There's a reason that, you know, the Ukrainians want us supporting Israel. Why? Because they know if Iran wins, Russia wins, and they don't want to do that. Everybody else sees this unholy alliance except for Americans. Americans have their head in the sand. If we do this right in Ukraine and Israel,
I agree with the ambassador / governor. I mean, I can't believe how many people I talk to and they say, well, we got to worry about our border. You know, Ukraine is not our problem. We only have to help Israel. They don't see the bigger picture when it seems to me so obvious. Or they say, you're warmongers. Nobody thinks. People in the military are the last ones that want to fight. And people who are in foreign policy knows the gravity of what happens after or during a war. Nobody wants it, but there's a danger in refusing to do it. Jennifer Griffin lives that every day. Fox News' chief national security correspondent. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian.
Jennifer, the most people you talk to in the Pentagon, do they agree with that, that these are all linked? And they seems to be, you can't just say Israel's the problem, Ukraine is the challenge, Taiwan's the problem. They see a linkage?
Absolutely, Brian. I mean, as you know, I have been covering the Middle East for my entire adult life, and I've been at the Pentagon for the last 16 years. And every day we are looking at this matrix of problems, and to not understand how they're all interconnected and how if you send a signal of weakness or that you're not willing to get involved on the right side of a conflict, particularly if we're talking about Ukraine, because that is a clear-cut violation by Russia invading another country, trying to erase the map of Europe. And Putin has said that he will go further. I mean, all you have to do is listen to our NATO allies who are in those frontline states, whether it's Poland or the Baltic countries. They know what happens. They know their history. And we as Americans need to know our history and need to understand how President Xi and President Putin are looking to see whether the U.S. is weak-kneed and whether it's going to simply focus inward and not be a leader in the world. And at that point, once they realize that the U.S. is not going to fund support for Ukraine or other situations where we have our military overseas, then they'll go further. They'll run amok. You'll see Taiwan taken over by China. It is so dangerous right now. And so to be playing around with these petty, small amounts of money that we're talking about on Capitol Hill, I mean, we're talking about when you hear a few billion dollars, of course, to you and me, that's a lot of money. But when you're talking about a massive defense budget that is supposed to prevent wars, sending $30 billion to Ukraine to make sure that they hold the line against an authoritarian dictator like Putin is a small – that's why you have a large defense budget.
Exactly. And by the way, we all contribute to it. You know, we have this defense budget. When you have your tax dollars, you do it because we want to project a sense of strength. So yesterday, we understand Sunday, time zone allowing, we hit two separate locations in Syria. This is a response to four attacks on us since we attacked since Thursday. What were those sites, and do you know about its effectiveness in taking out the target?
Well, Brian, we were the first to report this yesterday. In fact, I got a tip over the weekend that this had happened. And we had been expecting the U.S. military to respond because almost daily our troops in Syria and Iraq, you have 950 U.S. troops in Syria who are kind of keeping the lid on ISIS there. And you have 2,500 U.S. troops in Iraq making sure that the Iraqi government doesn't fall and then get taken over by Iran. And those bases where they are have been taking constant fire, rockets and drones from the Iranian proxy forces. Now, fortunately, no U.S. troops have been killed in any of those attacks, and the U.S. Military has beefed up the air defense systems. They've sent more Patriot batteries over there, and the troops on the ground, the U.S. troops, have been very effective at shooting down the drones being sent by these Iranian proxies. But it is constantly they're under fire. So this is the third time since October 17th that the U.S. has carried out airstrikes in eastern Syria. This time, the target was a little more significant than the past targeting raids. And they bombed an IRGC, an Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps headquarters. They killed about 6 to 7 Iranian proxy fighters who were sleeping at the base. And then at a second location in eastern Syria, they hit another weapon storage facility, which is where they do a lot of their training, and the Iranian proxy groups. And we know that they hit that excuse me, Brian, we know that we hit that, that the U.S. Military hit that second base because for 2 hours afterwards there were secondary explosions, and so that means there was a lot of ammunition, a lot of weaponry at that facility. What happened in response, the Iranian proxies were clearly angry at what they had lost because within minutes, a base where U.S. military is based in eastern Syria near the Conoco oil fields came under fire. There were about 17 rockets fired at that base. No injuries, no damage. But and then there were three other attacks on U.S. forces in eastern Syria today. What's happening is that the U.S. is going to have to send a stronger deterrent message to these Iranian proxies. And there's a great deal of hesitation at the White House and at the National Security Council level of not wanting to broaden out the conflict or give Iran any excuse to allow Hezbollah to get involved in the Israel fight. And so that is why you see kind of a tepid reaction by the U.S. military to these constant barrage of attacks on U.S. forces.
So, Jennifer, just to be clear, you're saying since we hit them on Sunday, they've hit our troops back?
They have tried to fire back. They've fired rockets four separate occasions since that airstrike was carried out last night. That is, again, no U.S. injuries, no damage to the bases, but they clearly are angry at what they lost yesterday.
So why do you think it is that we're hitting the Syrian border and not hitting locations in Iraq where some of this fire came from?
Well, from what my sources have told me is that it's very sensitive to hit inside of Iraq because you could be destabilizing the Iraqi government. Right now, the Iraqi government is very tenuous. If that government gets overthrown, you could see greater Iranian influence in the Iraqi government, and the U.S. would lose any sort of influence that it has in Iraq. So that is why you're seeing, even though the Iranian proxy forces are firing on al-Assad in Iraq, where U.S. troops are based, even though the troops in Iraq are coming under fire, the response from the U.S. military is coming in Syria because, again, it's very delicate in terms of the Iraqi government and the U.S. not wanting to destabilize basically a friendly government at this point.
So a lot of moving parts. There's nothing simple. I get it. But, you know, Dan Hoffman, who knows more than I'll ever know about the region, said and used to be a station in Iraq. He says that the Iranians like having that presence there. I could see how the Russians and Chinese would, but I wouldn't think there's any advantage to us having these aircraft carrier groups in the region.
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying. That
Dan Hoffman says that Iran likes the distraction, that we're in this region with such great force. And I can't see for the life of me why you would think that, because it seems to work against Iran's best interest to have our power on display.
Yeah, I think what he might be arguing, and I didn't hear what he said, but I think what he might be saying is that Iran is having huge domestic problems, as we know. They've had protests by the young women who wanted to take off their hijab. They've had to crush those protests. The regime is very unpopular. The inflation rate is incredibly high in Iran. They're having a cash shortage. And so they're trying to distract from their domestic problems by focusing outwards. And so to have the sort of what they call the Great Satan on their doorstep with a big aircraft carrier in the Strait of Hormuz, that gives the mullahs and the leaders of Tehran an opportunity to say, see, we have to do this. We have to support Hamas and Hezbollah and these Iranian proxies, and the IRGC is doing all this great fighting over in Syria and Iraq. It's a way to distract from all their domestic problems. So it's possible that what Dan is saying is that the aircraft carrier is such a large symbol of American power and prowess. But I think the message that CENTCOM wants to send to Tehran is, hey, if you kill Americans in these strikes on any of our bases, if you actually kill an American, and if you fire missiles, remember, the Iranian government has some long-range missiles. The ballistic missile program was one of the biggest problems of that Iran nuclear deal. because it was not touched. And they have ballistic missiles that could hit Israel. It could hit U.S. bases that are very vulnerable all across the Middle East. And if they use those, there's just a reminder, hey, we have an aircraft carrier group. We've got warplanes. We have a capability that you that it is unmatched, and just don't try it.
Yeah, I guess so. When you see who's has the most influence with Netanyahu, is he constantly on with State, Secretary of State? Is it with President Biden? Is it with Austin? And the pressure that he's receiving to pull back and so-called pause or ceasefire, where's that most of that pressure coming from?
I think his relationship probably is straight president to prime minister. So he's talking to the White House. It's they're certainly the defense chiefs. Defense Secretary Austin was on the phone with Defense Minister Gallant, certainly in terms of weaponry going to support the defensive missile defense systems that the U.S. has been sending over to Israel to protect Tel Aviv and other cities. That is coming through the Pentagon. So there are relationships, but I think Bibi Netanyahu is talking directly to the president and to probably Jake Sullivan. And I would say that when you talk about pressure, I mean, there hasn't been a great deal of pressure because you can see that the Israelis are moving forward in Gaza, and they are not they're not instituting any sort of ceasefire. But the White House also isn't putting pressure for a ceasefire. What they want are sort of four-hour windows so that humanitarian aid can get in. But the questions that they're asking are fair questions. The questions that the White House is asking and that the U.S. military, who has some advisors on the ground in Israel, is asking is, what comes next? Okay, you can go in there and you can clear out northern Gaza. You've moved 1.7 million Palestinians now to southern Gaza. Most of their residences are damaged in some way. Are they going to be able to return back to northern Gaza? What comes the day after? And we've heard kind of some doublespeak from Bibi Netanyahu. On the one hand, he told Bret Baier that Israel does not want to occupy Gaza when this is over. And on the other hand, the next day he went down and met with the southern communities in southern Israel and told them that the Israel would provide security in Gaza, for the near future in Gaza and after the Gaza raid, because they don't trust anybody else to do so. So it's really the day after is going to be, whenever that comes, whether it's a year from now or a few months from now, how they're going to manage Gaza, how you're going to have a government there, because Hamas is pretty woven into that society. I mean, it's a movement. It's not a small terror cell that can be eradicated. And so I just don't know who's going to lead. You have 2.3 million people there. What are you going to do with them? And Egypt is not going to take them. They don't want to leave. And Israel is going to have a very huge security issue even if they can get to the Hamas leaders and kill them. I mean, Brian, you remember I was in Israel, based there for 7 years.
Yep.
Every time I interviewed a Hamas leader, and I did so, almost weekly, they were killed very shortly after that. The Israelis were targeting and killing Hamas military leaders, bomb makers, as well as their political leadership while we were there. And a lot of the names that we see now, the names for hospitals there, are people that when we were there were assassinated by Israel. There's always someone to take their place. And so it is a real it's really difficult to understand what's going to happen the day after.
I know. I don't know. And I think they're openly.
I don't think anyone does.
Yeah, I know. When I hear them openly saying, Herzog and company saying, we'll know it when we get there, but we first got to get them out of there. So it's going to be a big standoff to see if the tunnels are under that hospital like they said they are. So
yeah,
it's going to be interesting.
It'll be interesting. And also, let's not forget the very key role that Qatar is playing in this. And I think a lot of Americans don't know the history of how Qatar was asked by not only the Bush administration, but also by Israel and by Bibi Netanyahu as prime minister to set up an office for Hamas in Qatar. So that was always part of the U.S. and Israel saying, hey, we need somebody who can at least mediate between Hamas. This is prior to this current outrageous, attack by Hamas, the incredible terror attack on October 7th, which nobody will ever be, which has really changed the face of everything. But prior to that, multiple U.S. administrations had asked Qatar to play a mediating role with Hamas. They've done so. The best way to get the hostages out will be through mediation with Qatar, because those hostages, if you go into the tunnels, I mean, you're pretty much assuring that those hostages will be killed. So it's a really delicate moment, Israel believes that by keeping the pressure on, that will help the negotiators. But again, this is a very dangerous time frame.
I did not know that Israel and the U.S. were behind Hamas opening up a office in Qatar. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it's a very interesting history, and I've seen the letters from various State Departments, and you know, going all the way back to Condi Rice, and then of course Bibi Netanyahu had always asked the Qataris to provide the money to Hamas in Gaza after Hamas won the election, so that the hospitals and that the government could keep functioning, because you know, the problem is Israel knew that you've got 2.3 million people there, and they need water and they need electricity. So Qatar is going to be the best bet to get those hostages out.
Jennifer, thanks so much. Busy time. I don't know how you're juggling it all. Jennifer Griffin, head security correspondent, and she's the one in charge. Jennifer, thanks.
Thanks,
all right,
Brian.
You got it. Back in a moment.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Just wrapping everything up. Hope to see everybody in Connecticut, Madison, Connecticut tomorrow. Signing Teddy and Booker T at Two American Icons, Blaze the Path to Racial Equality. I just love talking about our past, especially our recent past. Let's go to Cliff in Waterbury, Connecticut. Cliff.
Hey, Brian, thanks for taking my call. You come to Connecticut.
I'm sorry I
won't be able to see you. Wow, but listen, I feel real bad, real disappointed. Tim Scott dropped out. You know what I mean? You know, I thought he was a good guy. I thought you people liked him. What happened? He even picked up a white girlfriend.
I think he's coming back, Cliff. I think he'll be in it. I wouldn't doubt that he's going to be a finalist to be vice president. Notice Donald Trump. Notice that Donald Trump never went after him. Always said, surprised Timmy got in. Great guy. Always got centered, and he never went after Trump. So I think that leaves that door wide open. Brian Kilmeade, Joe.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.